Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, click on that Here We Still Stand banner so that you can join Chad and I virtually. Yeah, Chad and I are going to be doing that 40 Minutes in the Old Testament live. That's the whole conference, Chad. The whole Here We Still Stand conference, virtual conference, starts out with 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. We got something special planned, especially for you long time. Are you a long time listener? Have you been with us for years? Or maybe you're a short time listener and you've just binged and you've listened to tons and tons. Did you start from the beginning? If you were there at the beginning or you started at the beginning, well, we got something for you coming up on October 16th. So all you gotta do is click on that link at 1517, type in your email address and your name. It's free. You can sign up and you will get all the information sent to you. Join us and a whole host of other speakers and stuff for that conference, kicking off with 40 Minutes in the Old Testament live with something pretty cool that we're going to do. Also, Unveiling Mercy, pre-order still up. Book is roaring on the charts. I mean, that thing is just dominating. So be a part of that. If you haven't pre-ordered your copy and, of course, one for everyone on your Christmas list, now's the time. Now is the time to get that done. I'll put a link in the show notes, or you can go over to Amazon and just search, you know, Chad's name or Unveiling Mercy. Chad, what's going on, man?
Well, I had a good weekend. We got to see our grandkids.
There you go.
It's always fun.
I don't have any of those. Hopefully not for a while.
Wait a few more years. Yeah, it was fun. We got two grandsons. Got a granddaughter on the way. Be interesting to see what her life is like with two older brothers. I'm sure some of our listeners out there have experienced that, but we had a good time with them. Then back to work, to normality. Yeah, podcasting and doing a little bit of writing this week and all the other fun stuff we get to do.
Yeah, awesome. Well, we left Saul hiding in a bunch of baggage.
Yeah, what's up with him? Yeah, he is a strange character.
Yeah, so Samuel's ready to make this dude king, and. It is interesting. It tells you something about Saul. He's not, at least at the beginning, overly excited about this. He seems nervous.
Yeah, at the very least. Yeah, he's an odd guy. I mean, we met him looking for his dad's donkeys. He almost seems a little bit like dim-witted. Like he doesn't have any idea who Samuel is. And forgot to bring his wallet with him, has no money, even though his dad is evidently a pretty wealthy guy. And now when he's finally, you know, ready to be proclaimed king, he's hunkered down behind the baggage.
So, yeah, I mean, this did happen rather quickly. I mean, you'd have to be
shell
like
shock.
Yeah, you'd have to be like a crazy kind of arrogant to be like, yeah, all right, let's do it. This
is my destiny.
Yeah, what Saul seems like, at least initially, is like kind of a simple guy. He's like a big old dude but he doesn't seem like he's got political aspirations or anything like that. Just seems like a big, strong, tall, good old boy.
Yeah. Yeah. That's precisely it. He is not political. He's not out, you know, kissing babies and holding political rallies, but and this is significant to stress, because what we'll see over time is that he kind of grows into this, right? Mm. So he's kind of different. You know, some people start out with a lot of ambition, and then they get to a certain point, and, you know, after they get kicked around and bruised a little bit, they have, maybe a little bit more humility. And then you have the opposite. You have people who start out with some humility and, you know, just kind of stepping back from things, but they get thrust into a position that they never dreamed they'd be in. And then after a while, it goes to their head. And they become ambitious after the fact. So I think in Saul's case, that's what we're going to see with him. So he kind of gets, over time, he gets pretty comfortable with his office, you know? And then this new guy comes along, this young kid from Bethlehem, and all the ladies are just gaga over him, start making up songs about him. And all of a sudden, Saul's like, oh, I don't think I like this, you know? Now, all of a sudden now, the one thing he doesn't want to lose is being king, right?
Yeah.
So anyway, but we'll get there eventually. We're in the middle of chapter 10, And we have an interesting parallel. I think it's a parallel here. I don't know if I could convince everyone of this, but it's pretty hard not to catch a parallel here with something we have covered before. And that's the way that I left us last time. Kind of had this this lead in, this question to ask you as to what this reminded you of. So we are, let's see, we're at kind of the second half of verse 19 of 1 Samuel 10. So this starts out, this is not a very promising speech. This is Samuel talking about how God brought you out of Egypt. He did all this stuff for you. And then what'd you do? Verse 19. Well, you rejected God. You rejected the God who delivers you. And the way you rejected him is by asking for a king. Now, if I'm Saul listening to this pretty negative description of kingship, maybe I'd go hide behind the baggage as well. But here's how they find out. Nobody knows, I'm assuming, nobody knows except Samuel and Saul at this point, who the king is actually going to be. None of the people know. So we're going to go through this whole drawing of casting of lots so that the lot will fall upon the one that God has chosen. So at the second half of verse 19, they present themselves before the Lord by their tribes and clans. He brings all of them near. They cast lots, and the lot falls to the tribe of Benjamin. Well, they bring all the tribe of Benjamin forward by their families, and the lot falls to the Matrite or Matrite family. And then they cast lots again, and it falls to Saul, the son of Kish. And then we have this humorous scene where they look for him, but he can't be found. Now, what this should remind you of, the parallel account to this, is what we read in the opening chapters of the book of Joshua, the story of the infamous act of Achan. You'll remember that when the walls of Jericho fell down and they stormed the city, all the soldiers rushing in were given very explicit instructions not to take any of the goods from the city. Everything was to be devoted to harem, to destruction, or to handing over to the Lord. But, you know, Achan, he's charging in there with his spear or his sword, and he looks down, and man, there's some really good stuff that just kind of sitting around waiting for somebody to pick it up. So he does. He picks up a few items. He conceals it under the floor of his tent. The next battle, Israel loses. Joshua finds out why they lost it, because somebody took it. And so what do? Same thing that we just read. They bring the whole nation near by tribes, and it gets narrowed down from one tribe to one family to one man, and that one man is Achan. So if you're watching all of this go down, and you know the story of Israel, you're thinking, this is not a great parallel to be in right here, you know, because the last guy that got chosen by Lot after they went from tribe to family to individual, he got killed. So if you're Saul watching this, you're probably thinking, man, I don't want to be Achan number two. This is not a good setup for me.
You're wondering, like, I don't know this man of God real well, and this seems like it came together pretty quick. Maybe this is all a trap.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, how convinced are you that he's not going to be like, would it be like completely out of the realm of biblical narrative, you know, like of what we've seen in biblical narratives, for like, if Samuel calls forward a guy and then says, in your idolatry and adulterousness, you have asked for a king. Here's what God thinks about your king, and cut your head off.
That would not be unusual in the biblical narrative. No, I mean, I could totally see that happening.
Yeah, so I mean, I'm sure Saul's like, I don't know, man.
Yeah, so that's why, maybe that's why, one of the reasons, he's hiding. He's hiding, you know, in the military baggage. This word, this Hebrew word for baggage is, it can mean lots of different things, but it's often used in military context for, you know, you're hiding behind the tank, or you're hiding behind the Jeep, or you're hiding behind the boxes of military weaponry, whatever it is. That's where he's hiding out. And this becomes even more humorous because they can't find him. You know, it's like, he's even here? Where's he at? So they have to ask God, where's he at?
Which is hilarious.
I mean, I don't even know how you ask God that. I mean, I understand you could cast lots. It's pretty easy, right? you cast lots, figured out. I mean, if you believe that the casting of lots is the way that God's will is determined, well, that's pretty easy to imagine how that would happen. But how do you like ask God where somebody's hiding?
Unless you just ask him, you say, God, where is this guy hiding?
I suppose.
And then it just says that God told him. Like, I don't know if he just told Samuel or he told, like, just, I don't know how this worked.
I don't know either, but however it worked, that's what happened. God said, well, look, he's over there. He's hiding himself by the baggage. So they all run over and they take Saul and he stands there among the people. And we're told that he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. So how tall do you think he was? One of my commentators said 6'10". I'm like, are you just like making that up?
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think there's any place that tells us exactly how tall he is.
No, I don't think it tells you how tall he is. I mean, I suppose it's they probably are going with the average height of, and people were, I think people were shorter then as well.
But... yeah, it was like, I've read the average, I mean, of course, they can tell this from skeletal remains, but I believe the average height was maybe of an adult male was like 5'4". Maybe 5'5", something like that. So we're probably not looking at a guy who's 6'10".
I would think so.
You're 6'5", is that right?
Yeah, I'm 6'5".
I mean, he could have been 6'2". Yeah. Even my height.
Yeah, by like from the shoulders up, this is another way of saying he's a head taller than everyone else, right? So everyone else's head is coming up to his shoulder. This is not a rare occurrence for me at 6'5", but you have to be on the short side to only come up to my shoulder. I mean, be a full, but that, this was, he's probably 8 inches taller than everybody else. And so, if your average guy is 5'5", 5'6", he's coming in there at 6'2", but by comparison, that's going to look like a huge guy.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure that, if we could somehow take, the giant from, or the mountain from Game of Thrones, put him back in the days of Goliath. Goliath probably wouldn't have looked quite as big.
Yeah.
Well,
I've seen an example of this. Like, I know we were saying that Saul's the Rock, but he also might be John Cena. The reason I say that is I was in a coffee shop one time and I was getting coffee and John Cena comes like walking in there. I was looking at him. I'm like, that's John Cena. And I said to the person I was having coffee with, I'm like, that's John Cena over there. And he goes, are you sure? And I'm like, yeah, like that guy is enormous. And now, I don't know exactly how tall John Cena is, but he's just like this formidable guy. He's huge. I mean, he's a huge guy and there's no hiding, right? Like, that's how I would imagine this is, that he just like stands out. He's bigger and taller than everybody. And I just was looking at him and he had a hat on and stuff, but I'm like, dude, there's nowhere for you to hide.
Yeah. Well, that'd be the same with Saul. I mean, it's not like he's going to be hunkering behind a suitcase or something like that. I was trying to look up, see how tall John Cena was while you were talking, but I couldn't find it.
No, he is, I don't know. He's not that tall, but he still just stands out.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've all been around people like that. Yeah. Who's the guy from Dances with Wolves years ago?
Kevin Costner?
Name? Kevin Costner. Yeah, I was thinking of that when you were talking about your encounter. We were, my family and I were in Green one time walking along and this guy comes walking up to us and I'm like, man, that guy looks just like Kevin Costner. And somebody else said, that is Kevin Costner. We were all like starstruck. And my wife's the only one that actually spoke to her. she was comfortable. Yeah. Well, yeah, you're not used to seeing people like that, in real life. So it's tongue tied there for a minute. Anyway, back to Saul and him and his height. They bring him out to the people. He's standing tall than anybody else. And here's how Samuel describes him. He says, do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? Surely there is no one like him among all the people. So all the people shouted and said, long live the king. They didn't say that. That's kind of like a modernizing. They said, may the king live. That just doesn't sound good.
No.
So in Hebrew, it's may the king live. But yeah, long live the king sounds a whole lot more British.
It does. that they just held that over from the old King James. It's interesting. I mean, it's quite a statement. I mean, whatever it is about Saul, like, okay, obviously he's tall. But I mean, a statement like there is none like him among all the people. Like,
it's a pretty bold statement.
That's a pretty crazy thing to say. I mean, like, that is he obviously is a dude that must just really stand out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he's got to. I mean, with that kind of, like, there's no ifs, ands, buts. I mean, nothing like that. It's just like a straightforward statement. This is the guy. Nobody's like him.
Yeah.
He's got that going for him. We will say that. No one, and the Lord has chosen him. That's kind of a dialectic going on here between all of these accounts, because, like, it'll move from kingship bad to kingship goes to Saul. It goes back and forth. And we'll see that even in chapter 12. I think all of these kind of beginning of Saul's reign narratives, it'll go from, like, you have a king, it's going to be a bad thing. He's going to do all this bad stuff. And then it'll shift to, like, this is the guy. This is the one the Lord has chosen. So it'll seem positive on the one hand and then negative on the other hand. We'll be doing this dance for the next couple chapters.
Yeah, and this has got to be, like, very confusing if you're Saul. He's saying all this negative stuff about kings and kingship. And then also he's like, and this guy is clearly the guy because look how awesome he is. And you're like, I don't understand what's going on. Especially if Saul is sort of a more simple kind of dude, he's got to be very much like, I don't know if I go, like, do I want this? Do I not want, like, what is going on here?
Yeah. Yeah. You can understand. I mean, I don't believe this, but you can understand why some critics claim that this is like somebody took all these separate stories about Saul and just kind of glued them all together into this one narrative, you know, because it does have kind of that disjointed feel when you're reading through it. But I think the message is basically, look, this wasn't what God wanted. Wasn't his idea. They've rejected God as king. So it is bad. On the other hand, as God often does, he's like, all right, I'll work with that. It's not what I wanted. Wasn't my plan, but I can work with it. I'll kind of bring it into, we'll grandfather this thing into the covenant. We'll make it work. But just keep in mind, this wasn't what I wanted originally.
Right.
Okay. So next, just to wrap up the chapter, Samuel told the people, my translation has the ordinances of the kingdom. I can't remember what ESV had there, but it's mishpat in the Hebrew, which, it's usually justice, but mishpat can mean kind of the way things are going to work, right?
Yeah, I think the ESV is rights and duties.
Yeah, it's pretty good translation. I mean, we don't know what this was exactly. Could be just sort of a summary of Deuteronomy 17, you know, where the king is not to multiply his harem, is not to multiply his horses, and he's not to multiply his gold and silver.
Well, none of that will happen.
Yeah, money, women, horses. Those evidently were the three temptations of the kings. So at least two of those still remain for political leaders, at least the money and the women part. I don't know about the horses part. Yeah. Maybe we'll just have to jets.
None of the kings of Israel will ever multiply those things to themselves.
No, certainly not Solomon. They also should have, you know, made sure to tell the king, you also cannot multiply gods and temples to your gods in your city. In fact, I know I've mentioned this before, but it's worth repeating. The only positive duty of the king in Deuteronomy 17, the only thing, I mean, he's not told, like, to make sure the economy stays good or even to wage war against enemy nations, nothing like that. There's only one positive command given to the king in Deuteronomy 17, and that is he is to make a copy of the book of the law and to study it all the time. Period. That's it. I guess because Moses knew, God knew that, you know, if he doesn't do something like that, if he's not meditating day and night upon the word of God, then he's going to be meditating upon his harem, maybe meditating upon his horses, or meditating upon whatever is going to distract him from the duties that God's given to him. Anyway, that's what happens here. He writes it in the scroll, not book. I don't know why English translations do that. They always translate scroll as book, I suppose, because we don't use scrolls anymore. But books were not there was no such thing as a book until, oh, I don't know, maybe the 5th, 6th, 7th century. I can't remember my history there, but the Codex had not been invented until well after the time of Christ. So everything back then was a scroll, if it was any kind of big document. Writes it in a scroll, puts it before the Lord. Samuel sends all the people away. Saul goes home too. I mean, there is no, like, there's no capital city. There's no Jerusalem. I mean, well, there, Jerusalem has not yet been added to Israelite territory. So, you know, it's a new king, and he just kind of goes home. He's from Gibeah, and a bunch of guys go with him. It says, valiant men whose hearts God had touched went with him. So valiant can also mean powerful. It can mean prosperous. We're not exactly sure what is implied here when it talks about these particular men. Anyway, influential men or powerful men, they go with him. But there were detractors. There were these sons of Belial, worthless men, as we translate that. And they said, how can this one deliver us? Yeah, he may be the rock, you know, he may be head and shoulders taller than everybody else, but how is this guy going to be able to deliver us? And it could be, you know, Saul was from the tribe of Benjamin. The tribe of Benjamin had a bad reputation. They were the ones who about got wiped out at the end of the book of Judges. And keep in mind, too, Gibeah, that's where the whole gang rape of the girl happened in the book of Judges, too. Gibeah was a bad place. So maybe these sons of Belial are thinking, this guy, look where he's from and look what tribe he's from. How in the world is he going to be able to deliver us?
Yeah, but if you take this sometimes out of the mouth of worthless fellows, I guess if you ask the question, like, is this guy going to be able to save us? Well, depending on what you mean by save us, you're not wrong. No, this guy is not going to do that.
Right.
In fact, neither is his lineage. It's an interesting statement, right? You have these sort of worthless fellows that are like, this guy's no savior.
Yeah. It's a great example of how you can look at it in context and take it one way, or you can lift it out and just kind of look at it face value and be like, oh yeah, that's exactly right. You know? So they meant it as like a jibe against Saul, but we can also read it to be like, actually, you're right. You're more right than you realize when you said it.
Yeah. And of course, I like this, that it says that Saul held his peace. And I assume that what this means is that he didn't kill them all right there.
That would be precisely it. Yeah. And we'll find out at the end of the next chapter that he had a chance to do that. And he was actually, magnanimous at that point. Okay. Well, let's jump into that. It's a pretty short chapter. Chapter 11 is only 15 verses, and it's all about this kind of strange threat and how Saul comes riding to the rescue. So we start out the chapter with a guy who has a very unusual name. So in English, it looks like we would pronounce it Nahash, which I guess we can pronounce it that way. But in the Hebrew, it's Nahash, like you would write it in a C-H. A-S-H. Now, it's a strange name because Nahash is the Hebrew word for serpent. Like if you go back and read Genesis 3, the serpent that's there is the Nahash. So the guy, the leader is the serpent general or serpent king, we might call him. Anyway, we'll call him Nahash because I think that's probably the way that most people are used to hearing it. And he's an Ammonite. You remember the Ammonites, where they came from? Not a very good beginning. Ammon as a nation traced its way back to Ben-Ammi, and Ben-Ammi was the son of the incestuous union of Lot and his youngest daughter. So Lot, his daughters go to the cave. They get him drunk two successive nights. He impregnates both of them. One of the children is Ben-Ammi. He becomes the father of the Ammonites. And so Nahash, the serpent guy, he is an Ammonite. So it's kind of this is one of these kind of strange extended family type deals.
Yeah.
I mean, because the Ammonites are, you know, they're like your third cousin that shows up at the family reunion, but you always get in a fight with them. That's kind of the Ammonites and the Israelites here. So
I always thought that Ammonites probably had this. This is just me. Like I always feel bad for people, but maybe this is not the case at all. But almost like you were born outside, like you're outside the family by no fault of your own.
Right.
Right. You're like, well, I didn't choose this. Like, yeah. But it's like, oh, you're an Ammonite, man. Yeah, you're not.
Like
you're not.
You only got something to prove.
Yeah. Yeah. Like this. I mean, you can see how this could like give you an attitude.
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Like, psychologically, that would have an impact. Like you always had to prove, listen, I am more than the product of an incestuous union between Lot and his daughter, right?
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Yeah, you could definitely see that.
Yeah, you could see how they'd be like, yeah, our distant cousins think they're so much holier and more and so much they're just God's chosen people, la di da. you could see how this could go.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So he's an odd duck because so he goes up and he and his army, they lay siege to a place called Jabesh Gilead. Come back to that in a second. And all the men of Jabesh say to Nahash, make a covenant with us and we'll serve you. In other words, they realize there's no way they're going to get out of this victorious. So they're like, tell you what, let's make a deal. We'll sign a peace treaty and everything will, will be okay. Well, Nahash is like, he's okay with that on one condition. He said, all right, we'll make peace with you. But here's the one condition. I'm going to gouge out the right eye of every single one of you so that I will make it a reproach on all Israel.
Yeah. So this is why I say there's like an attitude towards Israel here that is not the same as if just some pagan group is rolling in with no connection to Israel whatsoever, they're just like either they kill these guys or they make a treaty with these guys. They're like, yeah, fine, join it. Like, yeah, we'd love to have you serve us. Like, come on in. That's not what this dude, like old Snake King, is interested in.
He's out for blood or an eye.
But, well, he's out for shame too.
Yeah.
Because he's someone who is dealing with shame. I mean, he's from a people who are constantly being reminded by these other people, no doubt, like, well, you know where you came from. And he's like, well, how about this? How about I just gouge out all your eyes and you can walk around like that? And then we'll see. We'll see who's got the shame.
Right. Yeah. Great point. Great point. So that's understandable. The next part's a little odd because the elders are like, okay, tell you what, just give us 7 days, leave us alone for 7 days. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to send messengers throughout all the territory of Israel. And we're going to see if there's anybody who's going to be able to deliver us. And evidently Nahash is like down with that. And I have no idea why, unless maybe he's so confident that there's no one who's going to be able to deliver them. He's like, yeah, I'll give you 2 weeks if you want it, because you're not going to be able to find anybody. So you can send your messengers wherever you want them to go, but it's not going to do you any good. Either way, he lets them go. So what do? They don't go through all the territory of Israel. They make a beeline for Gibeah, where Saul lives. And they tell all the people there the threat that they're under, and all the people lift up their voices and weep. All right, so bad situation, but they go to the right place. Saul is out plowing a field. Strange thing for a king to do, right? But at this point, I guess, what else is the king going to do? He doesn't have a palace, doesn't have all the kingly duties that later kings are going to have. So he just goes back home and it's time to plow the field. So he yokes the oxen and he starts plowing his field.
This whole scenario is weird, by the way. I mean,
yeah.
That you would be like, all right, so here's the options that are presented. All right, let us think about it for 7 days. And if we can't find anyone to come in here and work you over, then, maybe we'll probably go with it. But, like, give us a chance to find someone that can fight you. Like, this is an interesting proposal.
It is.
I mean, I'll be honest. If I was in this scenario, I don't know that it would occur to me, be like, can you give me 7 days to try to see if there's an army sitting around that could come save us?
Yeah, you got to give it to these guys. I mean, they were creative, and they must have been pretty persuasive too, because Nahash is like, yeah, okay, cool, whatever.
Yeah, and maybe he's just like,
maybe 7 days,
and maybe Nahash is just so confident. He's like, yeah, you go get somebody. You bring him in here.
Yeah,
you go right
bring
ahead.
Your biggest guy. Let's see what he can do.
Yeah.
So they go, and everybody weeps, and then Saul, he comes up. He's got this oxen, and he's like, what's going on? Why is everybody crying? So they tell him what the men of Jabesh had said. And then it's like we're back in the book of Judges here, because the Spirit of the Lord came upon Saul mightily when he heard these words. So this is just like straight out of the book of Judges here. And his nose burned exceedingly in the Hebrew. He got real hot. He got real mad. He became very angry. Now we have something else that looks like it's straight out of the book of Judges, because you remember the terrible story. Remember those dark days when we were in the book of Judges, when we had this Levite who either killed his almost dead concubine, or took his dead concubine and he cut her up in 12 pieces and sent those 12 pieces throughout the land of Israel. And everybody's, understandably freaking out, like, what's going on here? Well, that's not the only time something like that happened, because guess what Saul's about to do? He takes these poor oxen that have just been working in the field, and he cuts them up. He just cut them up, and he sent the pieces throughout the territory of Israel by the hand of messengers. They're like handing a skull to this one messenger. Now here's a shank to another messenger. I mean, I don't know how this worked, but these probably runners. I mean, the armies had runners back then. They, delivered messages back and forth. And so I guess these guys take off. They got this bloody shank. They're running along, and they run from town to town. And here's the message: whoever does not come out after Saul and after Samuel, so shall it be done to his oxen.
Yeah, this in my mind, they relay this message to Saul. He gets enraged, and he's just like this enormous guy, and he like pulls out a sword. And by the end of this, this dude has got to be just covered in blood. He's like giving parts of oxen to people and telling them that. I mean, the people have got to be like, okay, this guy is the guy. Like this
guy. Yeah, at this point, if there was any doubt, it disappeared. Yeah, I mean, like today they would like send a passive aggressive email.
Yeah.
Not in the Old Testament, man. They just send a bloody shank with a messenger saying, listen, you want this done to your oxen? No? Okay. Well, you better get over there to Gibeah and help out Saul, because he's about to go kick some butt and deliver these people. But it worked, It said the dread of the Lord fell on the people. I'm sure it did. So they all show up, and there's a bunch of them. We got, there's a split here. You got 300,000 sons of Israel. So those kind of the northern tribes. And you got 30,000 men of Judah. That division of Israel and Judah, we're more accustomed to hearing about that later, like after the division of the kingdoms. But evidently, even back then, there was some sort of division like this. Anyway, you got 330,000 guys, plenty of soldiers, no doubt. So they said to the messengers who had come, thus you shall say to the men of Jabesh-Gilead, tomorrow, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have deliverance. So the messengers went and told the men of Jabesh. And in the understatement of the year, it says they were glad.
They were glad, yeah. So Saul hears these dudes be like, this guy can't save us. And then he sends this message out to get muster all these troops. And then his word is in the way that the ESV translates it exactly this way, that, yeah, by the time the sun is hot, you shall have salvation. You have to wonder if this is part of what he's doing, like, all right, yes, he's upset about the whole thing, if these people coming in and invading and making insane threats, but also being like, I'm about to show you just how savior like I can be.
This had to have been in Saul's mind, all right, like, this is the chance for me to prove that I got what it takes. This is my opportunity, and you're about to see it. Now, I forgot to mention, this is very ironic. Okay, so Jabesh-Gilead, if that might ring a bell to you, that's, if it does, that's because if you go back to the last couple chapters of the book of Judges, remember after that, the whole terrible thing happened at Gibeah and they summoned everybody to come and to all the tribes of Israel, all the people were supposed to show up and they were going to attack the tribe of Benjamin, right? After all this happened, well, the tribe of Benjamin is almost wiped out and these guys have no wives, right? They're all single guys. And so like, we got to do something because otherwise the tribe of Benjamin is going to die out. So what can we do? And they're like, you know what? Who didn't show up? Who was like the one city that didn't show up to go with us to battle against the Benjaminites? And they're like, oh yeah, it was the people of Jabesh Gilead didn't show up. So they go to Jabesh Gilead. They wipe out everybody there except like 400 virgins, or I don't remember how many there were, but anyway, all these virgins, and they bring them back to be the wives of the Benjaminite men. So this is the place. So it's kind of a strange turn of events now where these people need deliverance now. Anyway, that's the background of that particular city. So what happens? Well, the next morning, Saul divides all these people up into three different companies. They came into the camp and they just struck down the Ammonites left and right. It says until the heat of the day, which I'm guessing is
basically they rolled up in there and they just killed Amorites all morning.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, that's what was going on. They're just wiping out Ammonites left and right until the heat of the day. And there were a few survivors, but it says no two were left together. So they were just like, you know, running away any direction they could to get away from the battle.
And this is
victory.
And as it always goes, when, you know, I mean, because you have the, it's implied that God is involved in this, right? I mean, like the dread of the Lord falls on, I mean, like so God is at work. And so, of course, what you end up with is no body count for Israel. Yes. Like and they do this obviously because they want you to know just how big a wipeout this is. And now I don't know how many guys these Amorites have, but 330,000, a lot of dudes.
It's a lot of dudes. Yeah. Yeah. And there's like, it makes it sound as if not a single Israelite even needed a Band-Aid. Like they're good, you know, no problem.
This is a big tactical error giving them the 7 days.
Yeah. On second thought, Nahash should not have agreed to this particular plan of affairs. So the serpent's the head gets crushed, we might say. One commentator, I think quite creatively said that Saul is sort of being raised up here as a second Adam, an Adam type figure, right? And the question is, will he crush the head of Nahash the serpent? Well, he did. He crushed that head. And we just wrap up the chapter before we're out of time here. The people said to Samuel, so Samuel just shows up all of a sudden. I guess he was there. Who is he that was saying, shall Saul reign over us? So these are these sons of Belial we heard about. Bring the man that we may put him to death. Now, I don't know what Samuel would have said, but Saul steps forward. And in a brilliant move, I think, at least brilliant move politically.
Learning fast.
Yeah, he is learning fast. He's like, no, you guys, listen. Today, the Lord has accomplished salvation in Israel. He's pretty sneaky here, too. Notice he puts the finger on it. He says, the Lord. He doesn't say I, right? The Lord has accomplished. So he's giving God the glory. God has done this. So because that's happened, he says, not a man shall be put to death this day.
Yeah, the way I read this is, yes, it's like a good political move. Yes, then he's like giving God the credit, which is just a good move in general. But what he's also implying, like, hey, look, we went to war with these guys. No Israelites died, so no Israelites. No Israelites are going to die today.
Yeah. Yeah, as it should be, right? I mean, this is smart theologically, smart politically. It's a smart way to proceed. So good for Saul. I mean, as far as like his first real action as a king, it's pretty hard to do any better than this.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Sent a very powerful, clear message. And then to finish the chapter, Samuel says to the people, you know what? Let's all go down to Gilgal I don't know why Gilgal. That was like the initial headquarters of Israel when they entered into the Holy Land. Maybe it was still important site for that reason, but it says, let's go to Gilgal and renew the kingdom there. So they do. All the people go to Gilgal. They made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal, and they offered sacrifices of peace offerings before the Lord. And Saul and all the men of Israel rejoiced greatly.
Yeah, this seems to end. This chapter seems to end with sort of everyone's on board now, right? Like, yeah, I mean, because even the guys that were doubting probably are at this point, they're on board. And you could know that everyone else is on board because they're so on board that they're like, if anyone's not down with this guy, we'll kill him right now.
They're on the team fully at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and if this is all we, you know, this all we kind of knew about Saul, man, the guy gets gold stars, right?
Yeah. He did great. Off to a good start.
Off to a good start. He's empowered by the Spirit of God. He's shown exemplary humility. He is leading Israel in their battles, which is what they wanted, right? That's why they wanted a king. We want a king who's going to go out and defeat our enemies. Well, they got what they wanted. And everybody is unified at the end. They go to worship, they go to church, and everybody's happy. Right, we actually ended a positive note.
Well, we'll see how long it lasts.
Being the Bible, probably not long.
All right. Well, that is it, guys. We are beyond time. So we will be back with chapter 12 next week. Make sure you go and register for that Here We Still Stand virtual conference and pre-order Chad's book, man. You got to get on that book train. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. See you then.